things that I wanted to talk about today was really how we can take what we understand about the requirements for the kind of life that we are on our planet, and the thinking that is going on in terms of how we can try to generalize that beyond our own planet of origin to the other bodies in the solar system that may have some kind of potential for being life-bearing or life-sustaining. And beyond that, of course, in this amazing era of exoplanet discovery, to think about the fundamentals that could be used to assess whether a particular exoplanet might be a potentially life-bearing planet. Obviously, there are different degrees of data that we can collect from these vastly different types of objects. But a lot of the work that goes into planning these missions, of course, has to go on being informed by some mixture of our own understanding of life processes on this planet, mixed with our understanding of the fundamental physics and chemistry that we know goes on in our galaxy. So that's really the context in which my remarks are couched. This is really the question for astrobiology. Where is there a home for life in our vicinity of the universe? Obviously, we start close to home, and it is always somewhat easier to look for things that are at least similar in some sense to what you already have a model of. But we are certainly understanding more and more as we see more unusual types of planets appearing in the exoplanet literature that are not represented in our own solar system, that obviously we have to push our limits of imagination beyond that. Obviously, we aren't the only people to think of this. This is the earliest quote that I've been able to find that really sort of nails the whole exoplanet issue. This was by Giordano Bruno, who met a very sad end during his lifetime because he was not in sync with the thinking of the day about the role of Earth. But he says, there are countless suns and countless Earths all rotating around their suns in exactly the same way as the seven planets of our system. We see only the suns because they are the largest bodies and are luminous, but their planets remain invisible to us because they are smaller and non-luminous. He'd already nailed it. It took another 400 years, of course, before we began to actually confidently claim that we had detected such objects. Once you have a population of planets in your galaxy that you can play with in terms of life, you also have to think about what the potential is for the origin of some kind of lifelike process to occur. And the well-known astronomer Otto Struve, working in the mid-last century, after thinking about all of the astrophysics that he brought to bear on his own work, concluded that probably life processes were not that difficult to make, and that, in fact, life would have been sufficiently broad spread within our galaxy that we actually have to take into account the presence of not only life, but intelligent life. And he says, an intrinsically improbable event may become highly probable if the number of events is very great. Well, we have a planet-sized reactor, and we have geological time in order to conduct all those little mini spontaneous experiments that probably went on during the origin time period on our planet. He goes on to say, it's probable that a good many of the billions of planets in the Milky Way support intelligent forms of life. To me, this conclusion is a great philosophical interest. I believe that science has reached the point where it is necessary to take into account the action of intelligent beings in addition to the classical laws of physics. So this line of thinking has gone on to the point where we now actually have an actual field. We call it astrobiology. It was originally called exobiology when I was a little kid and started to get really interested in it. For the first 10 or 12 years of my own career, it was something that you did on the side. There were no degrees that could be earned in this. This is an emerging field that early on in its history was essentially sneered at as being no more than science fiction in the guise of science. But it has gained respectability and it's gained funding. So where there is funding, work goes on. And the lines of work that have come forth from astrobiology are legion, not just biological thinking, but also even the more fundamental aspects of what goes into making the biologically involved elements within the stellar cookers in which they're created. So all of that has come together to make this robust field. The ultimate goal, of course, is what I list here, and that is how do we find extraterrestrial life? That seems like a simple thing if you think about it from the point of view of looking for macroscopic life, but we're pretty sure that most life for most of a particular planet's history is going to be microscopic, and so it becomes a much more subtle problem how to look for it. How do we even recognize it if it is not like our type of life, if it differs in some significant way? Most of our analytical methods are focused on detecting what we already know is there and measuring what we know is there. So anything that diverges from our existing understanding is going to be very difficult to verify. There are other both ethical and scientific aspects of dealing with extraterrestrial life. The ethical aspect has to do with not interfering with the course of life of some other biosphere. The practical aspects of controlling any kind of contamination from Earth to another body is because you would mess up your own science experiments. So there is a fundamental science reason not to do it. Going in the other direction, how do you handle that life? Do you try to study it in situ, where you find it, on some other body? Or do you actually bring samples of it back to Earth, where much more sophisticated and long-term analyses can be brought to bear? We are the only home planet that we have, and so even though the chances of any kind of deleterious contamination are very low, the stakes are so high that a great deal of effort goes into assuring that when we send missions to other bodies in our solar system, they can bring back potentially biology-containing materials, that we know how to handle it. So these are very fundamental issues in how to deal with the situation. Planets are really the name of the game. These are the home of life. Much has been written since even the 50s about the so-called habitable zone that planets may be in with respect to their star. So the initial definition of this had to do with how far you were away from your star and whether or not your star was of a class that is similar to that of our sun. And if you were on a planet around a significantly different type of star with a very different mass, then the habitable zone would be shifted accordingly, and there are a lot of consequences of that. Obviously, the type of star that may house planets that are life-bearing is critical. For a long time, we ruled out red dwarf stars as being too unstable, producing large bursts of magnetic activity and radiation activity, and the habitable zone around such relatively dim stars would have to be very close to the star. And so the thinking was that any planets that close to their star would very quickly become tidally locked, and so therefore you would no longer have a freely rotating planet. This would create extreme conditions and so forth. People are rethinking this, partly because there's such a lot of red class stars in the galaxy. About 3/4 of all stars seem to fall into that class, and so people are taking another look at that. And then what type of planet? We have so far one example, and that is us on this planet. So the first quarry of interest, of course, are identifying other planets that resemble us in some significant ways, but there may be very many planets that are quite different from anything we have experienced in our solar system that may also be life-bearing. So it's proving challenging to expand our thinking in those directions. People have toyed, primarily in science fiction, with the whole idea of whether planets are essential for life processes. People have suggested that perhaps some kind of lifelike process might occur, even in the interstellar medium. But really, there's so little energy in those vast wastelands of almost vacuum that seems hard to pull off, even conceptually. Some people have suggested that some of the processes that you see or infer that are going on with stars resemble some lifelike processes, but in those extremely energetic environments, it's hard to know how something lifelike could persist, even if it was made out of very different materials than us. So it really is pretty impossible to constrain the question, but there are a couple of really good science fiction books on that topic, and Dragon's Egg by the late Bob Forward is one of the ones that deals with lifelike or life beings in a stellar environment. Any of you who are either working on exoplanet stuff or following the literature will, of course, be impressed about the amazing number of objects that have appeared on the scene, and to contemplate that really we only got the first really solid confirmation of an exoplanet in 1995. I truthfully had been waiting my whole life up until that point for such confirmation. Because of the work that I do with astrobiology, it's important to have other planets to think about. I regularly teach an astrobiology class at the graduate level for biology, geology, physics, and chemistry students where I teach. And I was keeping a running tally over the years about how many. And then, of course, the Kepler mission occurred, and that just blew all previous estimates out of the window. So as of a couple of days ago, there are in excess of 3,500 candidates that Kepler has identified and 167 confirmed. Now, Kepler got into serious trouble losing two of its reaction wheels, and so it was thought that it was a dead mission. But now there's a scheme afoot to actually use the sun itself as sort of a hoped-up third reaction center, so to speak. And so the mission is not dead, it's just reduced in competence. But even if the mission had ended when those two reaction wheels went down earlier this year, we have such a vast array of candidate planets that need to be laboriously confirmed that the mission has certainly paid back what it costs to send it. Some of the really exciting aspects of this are the multi-planet systems, because this provides another look at solar systems like our own, or perhaps very different from our own. And there are hundreds that have been potentially identified, and of those, in excess of 50 are now confirmed to have multi-planet systems. So this is the latest running tally in a graphic form that the Kepler mission has put out. And you will notice this is done by size classes of objects. The first objects that were identified, of course, were the massive Jupiter-class objects, because they're easier to see by direct transit in front of the sun. But it turns out that there are a lot of Neptune or super-Neptune or sub-Neptune-sized planets. And many of these are much closer into their star than our Neptune is to us. Ours is a ultra-cold outer solar system icy world, but those types of volatile rich planets seem to be appearing more and more frequently close enough to their star to potentially be in what we would consider the habitable zone for that star. And then the number of Earth size, which is one Earth mass plus or minus about a quarter or half of an Earth mass, really are now the target of focus because of the connection to life, because of our desire to compare ourselves with other planets that resemble us. Perhaps one of the most informative things that's going on is, as we well know, stars and planets are born together. And there are several systems that have been identified where we can actually see the birth of baby planets. And this is really critical, because a lot of our thinking about the origins of life on Earth have to do with how that life could originate and survive during what was clearly a lot of relatively violent processes going on our planet. There are questions about how soon that may have occurred after our planet initially accreted, where we got our oceans worth of water. Was that intrinsic to the accretionary bodies that made up the planet, or was that delivered in what's known as the late heavy bombardment, this great period of impact about 4 to 4.1 billion years ago that so scarred the moon with the giant Maria and produced the huge Caloris Basin on Mercury and pockmarked a lot of the icy satellites around the outer solar system. So being able to actually look at this birth process and study that in detail in other systems is going to inform us greatly about our own ideas about this solar system and how that relates to life. Obviously, one of the biggest issues with assessing whether a particular solar system at least has the conditions physically and chemically to support some kind of origin and perpetration of life has to do with the nature of the star. The real caveat here is supermassive stars and massive stars have lifetimes that are quite short, and so therefore, should any kind of life origin occur on those, it's not going to have a very long tenure because the lifetime of the whole system is not going to be very long. So the sun itself has to be at least relatively stable. It needs to provide a relatively stable source of luminosity if that's going to be the primary energy-deriving mechanism in a particular system. Generally, what people are trying to focus on now is of course, main sequence stars. They're significantly less massive than a type A, maybe more massive than type M, although, as I pointed out earlier, M stars are now in vogue to be sort of revisited. Even some of the more massive stars could conceivably support life for some reasonable amount of time. So class FO, 4 would perhaps live for several billions of years, and so that would provide at least several billions of years for life to be kindled and then develop. probably over that short a time period, complex life forms like us might only just be beginning to form. We know that on our planet and its record of the life that has been here, we can trace that back to about 3.8 billion years. Of that 3.8 billion years to now, three quarters of that period of time was strictly microbial. Apparently, if we are any model for what generally goes on, it takes a long time to invent large, complex structural organisms, and even longer to produce something that we enjoy as cognitive intelligence. So, obviously, a short duration biosphere may not be able to produce more complex life, but probably could produce microbial life. so, just to sort of sum up the real estate aspect, there are a number of papers that have appeared, and I've sort of jotted them down at the bottom over the last 2 years, trying to sum up what we can infer based on this partial population sample that we have from the exoplanets that we have in hand. And the conclusions by some are that perhaps half of all the stars in our galaxy have planets. When you work the numbers, then maybe you have about a planet and a half apiece on average. If you generalize that over the galaxy, you're looking at 160 billion planets in the galaxy, and maybe 100 million or so might be habitable planets, but their definition of habitable planet is Earth-like. So an Earth-like planet that might be habitable. There are probably other types of planets for which we have no model that are not being considered in those calculations now. Perhaps 4 to 8% of the so-called sun-like stars that match us fairly closely in terms of mass, but also relatively close in terms of age, being sort of middle-aged, kind of in the middle of their spectrum. Perhaps somewhat under 5 or 10% have Earth-like planets, once again, meaning these rocky terrestrials that we represent. This is big news because we used to think of the solar system as being essentially the model for what other solar systems might be. It's been perhaps one of the most stunning revelations in any science in the last decade or so that this is not the case, that our happy family of planets is actually maybe not representative. And I show that so that I can show this one of my favorite pictures. So we may actually be the product of much more early, more violent actions within our solar system than we think. A revelation to me, because it's outside of my normal field of thinking, is the degree to which people who work on the orbital dynamics of the solar system and its bodies are thinking more and more that the outer gas giant planets were actually formed far away from their current position. And this means that in the early solar system, there must have been a lot of moving around of objects. And of course, this means that the stability of the system from the point of view of trying to give rise to some kind of life might make it harder. On the other hand, precipitating events that may create differing conditions on planets might actually provide some conditions that would be the spark of life. So at this point, it's really too early to tell how that's going to go as we see that kind of work go forward and work out. As I'm sure some of you are aware, a few months ago, the Voyager 1, whose launch I actually attended in 1977, just actually really left the solar system. And even though we know that because of the age of the spacecraft, it was a very primitive machine compared to what we can do now, but it's hung in there for many decades and actually managed to be the first object to escape our solar system outside of the sun's influence at about 126 AU from us. When you see the images that this little device took, almost 20 years ago now, 18 years ago, in 1996, you can see that already the tiny amount of the mass of any given system that is actually swept up into planets is really small. So these are tiny little oases of unique chemical and physical conditions. And this is what we are, of course, attempting to not only find around other bodies, but I think of it as us coming into the age of comparative planetology in the true sense of the word, when we can actually do population studies on exoplanets and compare them for their properties. The biggest obstacle that we face, of course, is the fact that the amount of data that we can get about an exoplanet around a distant star is minuscule compared to what we can get from the bodies in our own solar system. And those are, of course, greatly reduced data sets compared to what we have studied here. But a lot of those objects we can actually reach with landed missions and orbital missions, which is certainly outside of our grasp for the foreseeable future when it comes to other solar systems. So I've talked about the real estate. I want to talk a little bit about life, because life as a phenomenon is very impossible to nail down. And every biologist, chemist who works in this area, or physicist who works in biophysics that I know, would have their own laundry list. This happens to be mine. How do you know you have life when you find it? Well, I think that boundary conditions are essential. You have to have an inside of the organism and an outside of the organism so that the inside of the organism can be protected from the outside, so that it can sequester materials and energy, and so that it can be in a different state. Energy, of course, is critical to life, and not just a passive energy flowing through the system, but a life system has to have a way to actively seek, in some sense, or actively receive and process an energy source. Of course, what drives most of the action on our biosphere is the sun, but there are other alternatives that I'll discuss in a minute. One of the symptoms of life being on a planet that we see is an extraordinary amount of disequilibrium with what we would expect for a lifeless case in terms of the atmosphere, in terms of the geochemistry. Bob Hazen, who is a well-known mineralogy person, and a team of other people a few years ago produced a really revolutionary paper that pointed out that if you look at all the mineral species that we have on Earth, we have in excess of about 4,500 different identified minerals, and more are being found on a slow but steady basis. This is far and away more mineralogical richness than on any other body in our solar system that we've been able to study so far. And he and his colleagues attributed this to two important processes that occur here, or two features that occur here that don't seem to occur in other bodies. And one is the presence of liquid water on the planet at all times, and the other is life. And the geochemical effect of life and the water on the system has made us much more rich in terms of the diversity of materials. So this is definitely true of the atmosphere as well. These entities, whatever they are, have to be able to reproduce themselves, or you don't get a species, you don't get a population. And once that occurs, they have to be able to perpetrate the information coding for how to make themselves with at least a relatively high degree of fidelity from one generation to another. And the minute you do have such a system, then, of course, it's going to evolve. All systems evolve, whether they're biological or not, if they have complex interacting entities. So that's my list, but I bet you could ask any one of my colleagues and some of your colleagues, and they would come up with a different list. Some of the conundrums that we face when trying to understand the fundamental nature of life is that we really have been thinking about it as a black and white kind of problem. You're either alive or you're not. And I think that this is quite untrue. There are degrees of lifeness. So for example, people always say, well, is a virus alive? It doesn't have the ability to generate more of itself and grow until it hijacks some other functional cell. I would say that, you know, the only way to answer those questions is to do something like I've prepared here, which is a sliding scale from the potential to manifest life, sort of like potential energy, and the other end of this scale, which is where life is actually an ongoing process. So a dead organism still has a lot of the features that it had when it was alive, but it has slid to the left and become less lifelike. Perhaps a dormant seed or a spore from a microorganism has the potential for life, but it is currently inactive. So this is the way I actually deal with this apparent conundrum, which I think in many cases is not helpful, to wonder whether or not something is alive or dead in that sort of binary sense. It may be that we have to cope with this kind of sliding scale in actual fact, because there may be organisms that spend a great deal of their time in the dormant form, and yet nevertheless they are the potential for life to manifest itself. What are we actually expecting? Well, sadly, we're not expecting anything like this picture. You know, when I was a little kid, I wanted to get into my spacecraft and go look for stuff that looked like that. Lots of tentacles were important, and preferably fangs would be good. But because we know what I just told you, which is that for three quarters of the history of life on this planet, we didn't have anything like this that was big and with lots of body parts, then we are probably looking in our own solar system for microscopic life forms. And these are subtle and difficult, actually, to find. They may be very different in terms of how fast they live. So one of the lessons that I have learned from the work that I do in caves and mines on these indigenous subsurface microbes is they don't have anywhere to go. They're not outgrowing predators. There are no higher life forms down there to eat them. And so they are in an energy, very constrained environment, so they don't grow very fast. And this makes them exceedingly difficult to work with. So while a conventional medical microbiology person might be able to bring up a culture of organisms in a few hours or a few days, in many cases, our experiments take months to many years. We have some that have been running for well over a dozen years. We have some that have been going for 15 years. And so the perception of another organism is only possible to the degree to which you can actually employ your analysis tools to actually find that. In the case of some of the bodies in the solar system, like Mars or Europa, the life may not be on the surface should it exist there at all. And that makes it much harder to study. In the case of Mars, of course, it may be in the subsurface, and we have focused a lot in our work on that possibility. And in the case of Europa, which is inferred to have a big ocean on the interior of the planet with many tens of kilometers of ice overlying it, it's hard to imagine how we can, in the foreseeable future, ever breach that ice and send a mission there that could report back out. But nevertheless, in our solar system, we have the ability to actually land probes and send things into close proximity around them. On exoplanets, it's much harder. An exoplanet, in order for us to really make the inference that it had some kind of life system, would have to have a very robust planet-dominating biosphere like we have here. Something more subtle, like a potential subsurface Martian or European biosphere, would be very challenging to even imagine how to go about detecting it. We have the clear stamp of life in the atmospheric gases on our planet. And of course, we can detect whether or not there is liquid water. Of course, if we go forward with the SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, if we're ever successful, and we make contact with another intelligent species, then they can tell us all about their biosphere, and they will hopefully tell us about their science and what they know about all sorts of things. So that's kind of an end run, but I'm not expecting that anytime soon. There's a distinction between what life needs. We wrestle with this all the time. I'm on a working group that is trying to decide where to make special regions on Mars that we will not send missions to because they may be biologically sensitive. And it always comes down to what does life need, and are the conditions in a particular area such that life could contaminate that area, so we should be careful with our spacecraft. The conditions that lead to the origins of life are not the same as the extreme conditions that organisms can eventually adapt to. And this is a subtle and difficult point because we can only imagine the conditions under which life probably originated here, a lot hotter than we have now, anoxic for sure. There was no free oxygen in the early Earth's atmosphere. And so there are some conditions that we can infer, but certainly the extremes on modern Earth that organisms have adapted to are much broader than that. So we have to specify what point in time we're actually thinking about life origins. Obviously, life has to have some kind of functional and structural biomolecules made out of something. And there must be an information coding mechanism that can be transmitted from one entity to the next. We use biomolecules. The complex charge patterns on clays have been suggested in the past as another way that biological information could be transmitted. We have a bias as a life form that is an aqueous solution of carbon molecules, that we are going to be looking for solvent-solute systems. It's a little hard to imagine solid-state life, although some people have gone that direction with science fiction stories. But certainly, even anything vaguely resembling us is going to require some kind of solvent. In our case, it's water. But there are plenty of planets that may have other liquids. We know from our own solar system that Titan around Saturn has liquid alkanes as its hydrology, so that would be alkanology, I guess. So other solvents may be in the picture, although water is an extraordinary material, and life in many ways has developed to exploit those special properties of water. Energy sources, of course, we talked about the habitable zone. This is the primary delivery of solar energy. All of the energy capturing mechanisms that we have in plants and algae and cyanobacteria on our planet are dependent on visible wavelengths. There's no intrinsic reason why long wave UV could not be managed by at least some biomolecules. It may be that we have such an overabundance of visible light that the more difficult problem of stepping down the energies of UV wavelengths has not been worth it. But nevertheless, in principle, a star of greater mass than ours would be having greater emissions in the ultraviolet, and perhaps that might be utilized as an energy source. Certainly geochemical energy, the oxidation of metals particularly, provides a lot of energy. Relatively speaking, for many of the organisms that we specialize in, and then perhaps even geothermal energy, although the amount of total energy contained in that might be hard to translate that into chemical activity. And then even radiogenic energy has been suggested. There is an indirect radiogenic energy source that is going on right here on our planet, and this has to do with the deep South African gold mines that people have been studying. There are microbes down at the 4-kilometer level, and probably deeper, but that's the depth of the current mines. These are the deepest holes on Earth. They're deeper than any natural cave. And the mining companies are planning to go even deeper. But the organisms that have been isolated for that environment are actually using hydrogen. And the hydrogen itself is the photolysis product of water that's being acted on by the radiogenic emissions of radiogenic compounds in the rock masses. So they're getting sort of secondhand radiogenic energy and using the hydrogen. Obviously, the stellar lifetime is important, as we've discussed, but the actual stability of the planet itself. So, for example, Mars has no big moon like we do, and that appears to have allowed it to have its obliquity flip back and forth much more extremely than ours does. So Mars has not only ordinary seasons like we do, but it has super seasons, sort of Milankovitch super seasons, based on this flip-flop in its obliquity angle. That's fairly radical change over timescales of about 100,000 years. So both of those issues kind of play in together, the presence of a big satellite. More and more people are looking at the role of the stabilization of our planet's orbital properties vis-a-vis the moon as being perhaps one of the important ingredients to why we are a life-bearing planet. The last item on this list I think is really critical, and it has not been focused on, and that is that over the lifetime of a planet, chemical reactions occur both biologically and abiotically mediated, and you kind of run out of stuff. So our planet has this wonderful convecting cycle that slurps material from the surface back down, recooks it and alters it, and then spews it back up at spreading centers. So we have this inbuilt ongoing plate tectonic recycling mechanism. Mars has no plate tectonics evident, and so whether or not this might have been one of the factors that would have made life on Mars either a short-term prospect or not happen at all, and certainly would have shortened any lifetime, viable lifetime for a biosphere. One of the exercises that Shlovsky and Sagan went through, I think this was in the late 70s, it might have been in the early 80s, was just done as an exercise to point out that really the effect of Earth life on Earth has been highly disproportionate to the amount of actual matter that is involved. So you can see by these numbers as you just glance down them that life is a fraction of a percent of the mass of the atmosphere, and it's 10 to the minus 10th of the mass of the Earth. So on a mass basis, life is a minor component, and yet its turnover time of materials makes it a dominant set of processes on this planet. All of this stuff has caused me in the last few years to really think more deeply about what we're looking for. So I've started to distinguish planets into two different kinds of biospheres. This is, of course, Earth as our example. And we have good sunlight for driving biological processes because we're in the so-called habitable zone. We have this flamboyant coating of green protein known as chlorophyll. It's the most predominant protein in the whole biosphere. It can be detected spectroscopically, of course. The planet is gooey, so to speak, meaning that it's got a nice coating of life on it. And the gases in the atmosphere are in wild non-equilibrium. And so we have life written all over us. The critical zone, which is where the life occurs, perhaps to the lower stratosphere and down maybe 10 kilometers in the crust, is churning materials and energy transfer all the time. And so this is called the critical zone. And in our case, it's mostly photosynthetically driven from the top down. But if we go to the other cases that I have touched on of Mars and Europa, this is a very different biosphere type if they, in fact, actually contain any living organisms. The surface shows no visible means of support, so there's nothing like chlorophyll. The gases, such as they are on Mars, and Europa has a negligible atmosphere, but they are very much not out of equilibrium. There's nothing extraordinary or surprising. And if we imagine that these actually have a biosphere, then it would have to, by force, be driven from the bottom up. This is a process of getting energy for life processes out of inorganic materials is called chemosynthy, or chemosynthesis. So depending on where we're looking, we may never be able to see any planets of this type 2 type and be able to tell. So I've mentioned the habitable zone on several occasions. This is a diagram that is sort of showing how it scales with the mass of the star. One, of course, is the relative mass, by definition, of our sun, as you can see up there. And you can see the pathway across that, and you can see where the habitable zone is. But of course, we have added these habitable zones around gas giants because around gas giants, the icy bodies or even non-icy bodies can be tugged tidally and heated by that frictional force over time as they are being pulled by their primary planet and their fellow moons. One of the things that is concerning and really affects our ability to calculate how many of the likely solar systems that are out there might be stable enough to give rise to life, and that is that there seem to be a lot of eccentric Jupiters out there. Of the hot Jupiters that have been found, where the Jupiter-sized planet is very close to its star, but there seem to be many more that are coming in at very elliptical angles into their solar system. And a body the size of a Jovian planet is going to really highly perturb the system. So it may be that any systems that have these sort of rogue gas giant planets are going to be so unstable that that life may have a very hard time getting a hold there. I want to talk briefly about alternate energies for life. People have speculated about what color would chlorophyll be on a particular star and so forth. And you know, it's an entertaining guessing game to play, but it has real significance. There was a paper by Barras and colleagues in 07 that sort of touched on this. There was a paper, and many papers since, by Steve Benner, who is a very creative chemist, biochemist, who thinks about alternative life chemistries. But they were struggling with this issue. What do you need for alternative wavelengths for light? Where are the stars that could produce things that would still be supportive of some kind of life process? You have to have enough energy to really support some kind of biosynthesis. You have to be able to make and break bonds and create molecules, but at the same time, you can have so much energy that you actually then just degrading those molecules as fast as you're making them, or you have to be able to have them in some kind of environment where they're hidden from the destructive forces. One of the important things that's been pointed out, and I think you can see it here, is this so-called red edge. Here's the bump that you get in a reflectance spectrum from chlorophyll. And then there's an abrupt transition to where you're seeing water reflection. And it's been suggested that this, this red edge actually be looked for on a number of different planets. We ought to be able to see it spectroscopically with you know, good enough tools to look. There may be other anomalous things that would show up in reflectance spectra that might indicate the presence of some kind of light-trapping pigment. Chlorophyll is not the only light-trapping pigment we have. It's just that it's so dominant, it covers up everything else. So trees become yellow and gold in the fall because they're losing their chlorophyll first, and we're getting a peek at some of the other light-trapping pigments that that they contain. So there are more than one way to actually trap photons and couple them to the mechanisms that produce biomass. Alternatives in some stars where you have a peaks in the UV from the natural spectrum of the star. We have no examples on Earth where we know of that UV is used, but intrinsically it's perhaps possible. There may be ways to step down those energies that life may find. And on the other end of the wavelength spectrum, we know of no organisms on this planet that use infrared. But if we are looking at red dwarf stars that peak there, it may be that those would be conditions under which such a capability would occur. Photosynthesis on this planet is not all that efficient, so it's not like we have a high bar to break in terms of the basic chemistry and physics of what goes on. The total amount that's consumed in photosynthetic processes and hence biological processes is thousands of times less than the amount of the solar insulation that is delivered at the top of the atmosphere. The photosynthetic energy capture is 10 times more than is actually translated into biomass. And if you just glance through those numbers, you'll see that the practical efficiency down the bottom is only a couple of percent. So that's all you need in terms of capturing the energy of your star in the wavelengths of the visible part of the spectrum, which is what chlorophyll is specialized for. A very important point was made by Jim Casting, who is an atmospheric modeler who's worked on early Earth stuff and modern Earth stuff and planetary stuff. And as you can see from that little graph that I show, the brightness temperature profile of Earth is vastly more complicated than our nearest neighbors of Venus and Mars that don't have an apparent biosphere on the surface. So we certainly see in the gases that are important for life, which I list here, you can see that their photocatalytic half-lives are really very short. Ammonia doesn't hang around for more than a few days, sometimes a couple of weeks under certain circumstances. You have a decadal scale for methane. And hydrogen sulfide, which is a major energy-producing molecule on Earth, particularly in early Earth, but even now in specialized systems. So you can see that if there were not active processes producing these all the time, that they would quickly disappear from the atmospheric signal. This is the only slide I'm going to show you this afternoon of my own work, but we work in a lot of extreme conditions. These are extreme heat, extreme cold, chemically toxic. This is a sulfuric acid cave in Mexico with a lot of hydrogen sulfide coming into it. These are all biologically unique or rare circumstances that we have studied to try to look at the organisms that make their living and are happily adapted to this. You know, it's enough to kill us. But these guys are experiencing home sweet home. And so they have been able to develop the mechanisms to survive in these environments. Well, why do we want to do this other than to get on TV is to really push the envelope of what our kind of life can do. Because some of these conditions, while they're extreme here, may be the average conditions that you might expect on some other type of planet. And so it's really sort of pushing the envelope within which life can occur. Even on this planet, we have a very challenging set of information that we're trying to follow up on. We've been studying these bizarre little structures that you see on the right-hand side. They look like mesh stockings, or we also because we live in the Southwest, where there are lots of cacti, the Cholla cacti, these look like skeletons of Cholla cacti, except that you can see this scale bar up here, and if you can't read it, this is 1 micrometer. Okay, so these are tiny microscopic entities. We find them in caves all over the world, of every different kind of rock type and every different kind of geochemistry. We've been working on them for many years. We do not know what they are. So if it is that difficult for us to try to identify what clearly is some kind of life structure, even on this planet with all of our capabilities to bring to bear on that, imagine how much more challenging it is to try to do some of this work when you're dealing with another planet. I want to show a couple of pictures just to give you a little bit more insight. This is a very hot system, 40 to 60 degrees centigrade, that we've been working in Nica, Mexico. And the only reason we can get in there is because this is a mining area, and so they are pumping water so that they can get access for mining. And what was discovered was that there are these cavities with these gigantic crystals in them. The important thing about that, besides the fact that they're the biggest crystals on the planet, is because they contain little pockets within them. And those little pockets have fluids and gases and solid material. Oops. And they are containing organisms that we've actually been able to rehydrate and feed and bring back to life, so to speak. And the depth within the crystal to which we've been able to penetrate amounts to about the last 50,000 years of growth. So at least at the level of a few tens of thousands of years, these microorganisms were able to kind of hang out there and remain viable while not being active and still be alive enough so that we could actually grow them in culture. The significance for this, for what I'm talking about today, is that it occurs to us that maybe this is kind of what we're calling a geogenetic gene bank, really, within the geological materials on the planet. We know that giraffes probably don't do this, but we're focusing on microbes. So the microbial world may be able to actually recycle some of its gene content on geological timescales. So that's important for considering evolution on this planet, but when we're talking about the relevance of this to other planets, this swapping of material between relatively near planetary neighbors, as we believe and have significant evidence has gone on between Mars and Earth, means that amounts of crust have been blasted off Mars and presumably also Earth in the past, and this stuff hangs around in some kind of orbit and eventually makes its way and intersects the planetary orbit of another planet, and then a lot of this material makes its way to Earth. Well, you might say, of course, it's going to be destroyed on entry, and of course, much of the material that does come in is destroyed, but there are experiments that have been done on meteorite-like materials to see how far the heat of ablation as a particle or as a piece comes in through an atmosphere is going to get, how cooked would the inside be, and it's amazing how the heat is attenuated over the scale of perhaps 10 or 20 centimeters. So if you have chunks of material that contain microorganisms that are as tough as the ones that we are studying in that cave system I just showed you, perhaps they have the potential of actually surviving ejection from a planetary body, hanging around in space for a while, and then making their way to a second object. This is a kind of panspermia that is the most plausible. You know, the idea of panspermia with organisms sort of being blasted off and hanging around in space long enough to be the seed of life for another whole solar system, that's stretching the concept. That's stretching the ability for life to last that long. But I think that we are seeing perhaps some evidence that that might occur here. So what's in the future? We are very self-absorbed because we are intelligent and we have built a big civilization. But if you actually look at the prior history on the left of what we know of life on this planet, you can see that the first microbial age, of course, was very long. And now we're right in the middle of the age of animals, unclear how long we will dominate or how long we will last. But as the planet ages, as the sun ages, and we start to run out of internal geothermal heat, if we obviously see the changes that the sun will undergo as it's aging, it may no longer be a habitable system in the future for us or for our kind of life. Hopefully we'll have gone somewhere else by then. But then it may lapse into a second microbial age. And so this cushioning between microbial ages means that if you're looking for life elsewhere in the galaxy, you have no idea where on this timeline necessarily you might be seeing. And this is true for our planet, and we are using that as a model, but it is not to say that that is necessarily the only way that you can do this. So with that, I think I'll end my remarks. Thank you.
So as usual, we like to give the students the first chance for questions. So are there any students here that have questions? Okay, well, let's open it to everyone else then. Really, no questions?
You are the life forms I'm talking about, you know.
When you spoke about things you might observe on a planet that would indicate life, you mentioned something about mineral richness. Do we have any theory about how exactly life forms cause this mineral richness, or is it just a correlation that we observe?
It's a correlation, but Hazen and colleagues have actually done a very detailed study of it. So they have actually talked about the Earth going through its white phase and its red phase and its green phase as different changes have occurred. The red phase is when life has altered the entire surface and down to some significant depth in the crust by oxidizing the system. So when photosynthesis first arose, it was non-oxygen producing photosynthesis. It was looking at perhaps using hydrogen sulfide as the energy source. So the organisms, and we still have them today, they're alive now, in refugium pockets. We see that you can actually invent photosynthesis without putting off free oxygen. But as soon as the first organisms invented this different kind of photosynthesis, which was much more effective, much more energy providing, then that was the source of the free oxygen. And over time, of course, it's a big planet, so it took a long time for all of the rocky materials that were exposed to be oxidized, and for the oxygen to then start building up in the atmosphere. So the one radical change is that we essentially have a biologically oxidized crust, ocean, and atmosphere. And so this produced a whole suite of oxide minerals that would have not otherwise occurred. There are many more subtle things that are also manipulated by microorganisms. And one of the things that is significant is that sometimes the organisms are actually actively processing the materials. This is the case with iron and manganese. They're taking iron and manganese plus two, for example, in the manganese case, into their bodies. They are oxidizing it to the plus four phase. And those minerals that they're essentially pooping out are different from any other kinds of minerals. So that's the active process of life being involved. The passive process has to do with the fact that cells, bacterial cells and archaeal cells, have a net negative charge on their surface. So this then immediately attracts cations. And so there is a lot of mineral deposition that is passively mediated by the organisms. The ability of higher plants, once those arose, to actually invade with roots and root hairs into rock outcrops also then produces a whole suite of minerals that would not form if the rock material was not in proximity to these growing organisms. So we actually do know quite a lot in detail about exactly how these minerals are produced.
So you had this number early on of something like 100 million possible habitable planets in the galaxy, say. Could you elaborate on that a little more? So, for example, guess at how many might be in their Age of Animals or something like that?
Well, you know, that total number of planets is obviously at very different positions within its their life cycles. I don't know that anyone has yet actually tried to do an age cohort for that, but probably some industrious graduate student is doing it as we speak, I hope. And that will give us a better grasp of where we might find a mature biosphere, where we might find an early biosphere, and where we might find perhaps a planet that's going through the high degree of biological development that we have. But so far, you know, this field is so young of exoplanets that there is an embarrassment of data and a paucity of people working on it. So I think we don't have the data in hand to answer that, but that's, you know, an extremely important question that you raise.
You mentioned a couple of things earlier. One, the solar system is not typical, if I understood you correctly. Another is there some solar systems or planetary systems might have homicidal Jupiters. One thing I recall from some talk years ago on this is that Jupiter and Saturn seem to play an important role in our solar system by sweeping out comets and asteroids,
yes,
and stuff that can,
yeah,
clobber the inner planets. So,
yeah.
I mean, if we, in the estimate of habitable planets, is that used? And if not, how does it narrow the range down?
You know, I
mean, we want a big planet,
right,
far away and a good,
right,
planet close.
I don't think that the work has been done yet. I don't think that the work has been done yet. When they are calling them habitable planets, they just mean that they are of a Earth-like size, plus or minus, and that they happen to be in their habitable zone with respect to their sun, just from the simple metric of insulation. So a much more detailed consideration has to be done. It's probably the case that a solar system without its share of gas giants would experience much more impact in the inner solar system than we have. And so, yes, they are gravitational attractors and impact targets for a lot of that material coming in from the outer solar system. If Other solar systems have an Oort cloud, like we apparently do, then there's a metastable population of projectiles always available. And of course, we see them, as I know you know, through comets, like Comet Ison that just went the other day. So the degree to which that's the case is going to depend on the details of that solar system. In our solar system, it appears to be that we got a lot of that heavy impact out of the way early. One of the things that is hard for us to reconcile right now is that by the time we see the first evidences of life in the rock record at 3.8 billion, or certainly by 3.6 billion, it's already fairly sophisticated. It produces these things called stromatolites, which are complexly structured microbial mats. And so that's uncomfortably close to when the apparent time of the late heavy bombardment occurred. So some people have argued, Kevin Zonley, for example, at NASA Ames, has written several papers with Norm Sleep on the whole issue of did life arise before the late heavy bombardment? And then we had the late heavy bombardment sort of pelting the planet with a huge amount of material, sort of causing a surface sterilizing event. And so therefore, any life that was deep enough within the crust to avoid that might have been then the life that re-emerged onto the surface. So they're arguing that life must have arisen much earlier than that 3.8, which would put it into the window of the late heavy bombardment. So there's also the issue of the stochastic aspect of when you might have a heavy bombardment within a solar system. So it's, you know, it's so new that people have not really analyzed any of these systems in detail.
Well, so sorry, following that up, presumably if that were the case, then you could find like fossils on the moon or something of things that were knocked.
Mm-hmm. Yes, people have suggested that. You know, we certainly know that we have a lot of Mars meteorites here, the so-called SNCC meteorites, and those have been invaluable in helping us to interpret certain things about Mars. They've also, of course, raised the potential for there being microfossils in one of the objects, the famous ALH84001, and there are enigmatic tiny structures in there. The Antarctic meteorites are findable because they're falling onto ice. So they're falling onto a snowy background, so you can find them. People have discussed in serious terms how to go about looking for those kinds of objects on the moon. The moon appears to have a very well radiation gardened, sort of dusty surface. So impacting objects presumably would penetrate that, but that may not be the case everywhere. So there are plans afoot, if we ever actually get back to the moon, to do that kind of serious, you know, collecting science to look for those. I saw one more hand somewhere.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hey, sorry if I missed it during your talk, but could you please explain why the age of animals is so short on this final slide?
I think it's because there are several different factors that are coming to bear. One of them is that the mechanism of plate tectonics, which has been so instrumental in what are known as supercontinental cycles. So a supercontinental cycle happens about every half a billion years, which is where all the land masses sort of come together into a supercontinent, and then they pull apart again. This has been an engine for evolution. This has been an engine for biological innovation. As the planet ages, the amount of radioactive decay in its interior is going to be attenuating. The other internal heat source that, of course, we got from the initial endowment of heat from the actual accretion of the planet is another factor that is wearing down. A third factor is heat of formation. So as the planet's interior differentiated into the different parts of the core and the mantle and so forth, there was a tremendous amount of solid solution interaction, and that produced heat. So the notion is that the plate tectonics will become slower and slower in about 2 billion years. This is a sort of a notional idea. I would make the age of animals actually larger by some distance. But nevertheless, a lot of these supportive functions that our planet has been doing for us are going to start aging as the planet is aging. And of course, by the time you get to perhaps 8 billion years, 9 billion years, unclear, we are presumably going to do like other stars of our size class and start going into a red giant phase. And very shortly after that expansion of the sun occurs, we will no longer be in the habitable zone. We will essentially be more and more heated up by that and eventually engulfed. Now, the actual timing of that depends on apparently which stellar models you pick and so forth. So this is simply trying to illustrate the idea that it is not a one-way trip through biology, that it actually is dependent on where in the lifetime of your planet and your star you are, whether or not you're going to be seeing a full-bodied, highly niche-saturated biosphere like we have, or whether perhaps with much older systems than we are, we might be once again looking for organisms that are of the microbial class and no longer able to see the biosphere and the full bloom of its maturity. So, you know, we don't know how long that would be, but if you invoke all those processes that I mentioned, the planet will wear out essentially from the point of view of life.
You mentioned some very exotic life forms that we have right here on Earth, for example, that feed on radiogenic energy or live around volcanoes at the bottom of the ocean. Is there any evidence to suggest either that they come from a common ancestor or that they evolved separately?
Of the life that we have here that we're studying, is that what you're asking?
Yep.
No. Even the mysterious things that we are going after that I just showed you those pictures of, these little enigmatic mesh structures, everything that has so far been identified has the same fundamental chemistry. It has the same base pairs on the DNA coding for information. It uses the same suite of building blocks for building proteins and so forth. So no instance of a second type of life has yet come to light. Now, Paul Davies has speculated wildly that there is a shadow biosphere, that perhaps there is a different type of life that is represented in the microbial realm that is fundamentally different. His line of reasoning is that that origins of life events might still be going on, and if that's true, that we, with enough looking, might be able to see the products of those. I don't even know what I think about that. When you look at the biosphere, there are lots of inefficiencies in the way that biology does things. It is not an optimized system, but it's a system where certain key items appear to have arisen and then essentially been frozen in. So my mental picture of the evolution of these fundamental properties of life is that when you make a major invention, it doesn't have to be the best of all possible inventions. It essentially reduces the degrees of freedom in the system as a whole and essentially freezes those solutions that life came up with in place. So I think that you see the amount of latitude that you have for innovation within a biosphere to be gradually constricted, particularly when it comes to fundamentals. And, you know, in biology and ecology, we have something that is really a notional idea, but it seems to hold up for large organisms, and that is the competitive exclusion principle, which says that two different species cannot identify the same, or cannot inhabit the same identical niche. There has to be some offset in some aspect of their niche. Niche being, multi-parameter phase space that incorporates all of the different qualities that go to make up a habitable space. And if that's true, then I suspect that on any planet where you have one life system, that all other life systems essentially can't get a foothold and are driven to extinction. But I think it's a very important question to ask. Davies has not been well received within the biological community, partly because I guess he's a physicist and they don't like interference or something. But I think this is an important question. Should we be trying to look for things that are in a radically different mode? Not sure we know how, you know, because we have optimized all of our science tools to really look for the kind of life that we have. And so, you know, turning up something that's really, truly novel is perhaps going to be a matter for serendipity, should it even exist.
Any more questions? So let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you.